Let me read you what our manual says. The emptiness of dharmas, the emptiness, is a state of realization. It's a kind of ultimate truth that entails realizing this state, yet not being attached to it. And all pervasiveness, devoid of distinctions, that is its essence, and that is its characteristic. You know, so it's by me pondering on this statement, what does this mean, so that I can recognize it when I'm in it. Sometimes we're in something we can't even recognize it. We don't even know what's happening, you know. But this is getting to a place that not only is like if you see a person and you passed him every day on the street and you never saw him, and then all of a sudden you see him, and from that point on, every time you pass him, you recognize him. You know, you remember that you passed him. And so this that's why this kind of practice is important, because you're getting to do it in shorter and shorter and shorter periods of time. We think that we are making so much progress because we can sit for longer and longer and longer periods of time. But it's about the present moment is that short, shorter than that short. You know, so it's about being able to get into that space of realization. Just like that. And then after a while, you'll be like live sort of like in dual territory. You know, you'll be in both spaces. You'll be here and present with what's going on. And you'll also, that other space will all, it'll also be there. It may be there like in a non-imposing way, but then something happens, something said, something's done, and it jumps right up to the forefront so that you can operate in the moment with skillfulness. Around what? Around worldly dharmas. All worldly dharma is Buddha dharma. You know. And so this is true that all dharma is of one taste. But if that were a coin, then there has to be the opposite side of the coin. So it's true all dharma is of one taste. What taste is that? That's the taste of freedom, right? And the other side of it is that it doesn't have a single taste or quality. It has many tastes and many qualities. So you have to be able to be with the many tastes and the many qualities that are all amalgamated into one taste and one quality. It's like having three children, and you have to know the propensities of all three children. And you can give a guideline or a rule, but you still know the propensities of your children. You know your propensities. I say, when I had my children, that was when UHF or VHF one came out, you know, and that's when they started having adult content, not X content, but adult content. It wasn't so censored, you know, and I tell my children what they couldn't watch, could not watch. I get a phone call from my two daughters, Ma, Story is watching what you said we couldn't watch. I said, put him on the phone. He said, no, Ma, I'm not watching. I have my chair turned backwards to the TV. I'm listening. I'm not watching. You didn't say don't listen. You know, so I had to make a different rule for him, you know, to help him. He couldn't go in the refrigerator to get food because he would eat it all. Others would think about others and leave some for someone. So he could not go into the refrigerator unattended, you know. And so it's things like that. This is, so thinking that they are not real and yet they are real. That's a challenge. And that's what I want you to work on when you go away this weekend, seeing things as real and also as not real. Enter deeply, observe carefully. You know, these are not simplistic worlds. This is a very complicated world. And so is the The more we get to the true reality, the more complicated it is. But we can enter into it without feeling the complication if we are familiar with all the tastes and all the qualities. All the tastes and all the qualities. And so some of that means dissolving our sense of good and evil. Some of it means dissolving our sense of right or wrong. It's like wearing down the edges of absolute opinion about things, to leave some room for some negotiating, to leave some room for compassion, to leave some room for the exuberant feel of self-discipline, to leave some room for the humility of being able to submit to others, to leave some room. I mean, you know, there's no one thing you can direct toward yourself. You know, you have to let it all come and figure out how to duck and dodge and bob and weave and to stand boldly and take the arrow. It requires all of that. And then you become all things to all people that you might win, not all of them, but that you might win some of them. You know, things I thought I knew through my other spiritual disciplines, I thought I knew what those things meant. I thought I knew what those sayings meant. And I did have an understanding, a particular kind of understanding of those sayings. But what's so supreme about the Dharma is that those sayings come to my mind now, and I have a different way of understanding them. They have more depth to them, more clarity, you know, because I thought I understood, you know, but more clarity. And before I left the church, I asked Jesus, I said, how come we always constantly groveling at the altar? When do we come up to the fullness of the measure of your stature? That's what I'm looking for. That's why I'm in this, because there was a promise that we could come up to the fullness of the measure of your stature. And he said, for you to understand that, what that means, you're going to have to step out of this system. I'm like, but that's what gave me the courage, because I asked the one in whom I believe the question, and he gave me the answer. He said, to understand it truly, you're going to have to step out of this outer structure. And I went through a dark night of the soul. I went through everything, shamanism, science of mind, unity. Each time stepping a little bit further away from what I would consider, you know, the mainstay of Christianity. I went on out to Vedanta and then the Taoism, and ultimately on my 12th try or something like that, because I'd quickly hit a glass ceiling. I was right back with the same questions. I went to the Dharma, and it wasn't that, not only those questions were answered, but it let me see that there were so many more questions to ask that didn't even come to my mind, you know. And the Dharma is still helping me in that way. The Dharma poses the question to me, and I can't answer. Like, oh, I didn't even know that. I didn't know I had that question. I didn't even know that question to ask. You know, it seems to not have a lid. You know, and that's the joy of the observation and the root from which our principal truths come. Okay, so now we're at the end, and this is how I didn't get a chance to go into time with you today, but this retreat, but maybe another time. And it takes a little bit to understand, to experience the illusion of time. But these things will help you as you continue practicing in your own way, in your own tradition. But this is like seasoning and it'll make the food taste good. How does one observe and contemplate things as being like an illusion? The cause or origin of such phenomena cannot be determined. It's thinking that the phenomena is like a dream, or like a bubble, or like a shadow. It's a kind of false or unreal appearance. It's something that's so not concretized that your mind can just indulge in a way because to you it's not real. It's like a dream because you can wake up from it. It's like a shadow because you can see it, but you can't pick it up. It's like dew because the dew just evaporates before your very eyes with the dawning of the sun. It's like lightning, and you have a sudden insight or awakening. Or you might just call it a thought, but there was a spark of something that intruded into your mind that was not there before, and suddenly it's there. So if you think of life like this, rather than a 24-hour concrete existence, and we establish and set up our day, and it needs to go just like this, and any part of it that doesn't leaves me exasperated or perturbed or feeling out of control or angry because it's not the way I want. And suddenly all we're doing is actually living out our fantasy and living out what was not real because it was just fabricated by the mind that this is what today is going to bring. So it says, actually, in our arrogance, we think we're living in order and reality when we're actually living in delusion. And so when he comes along and says, think of life as it is, like a illusion, a bubble, you know, like lightning, like dewdrop that evaporates when the sun comes up. Says we think that that's folly and that's foolishness because we're so entrenched in our delusion of our capacity to structure and carry out the day and to control our life. It says, but true control of life is when we can just act naturally. That we leave the unstructured time to connect with that universal part of us that is part of everything else. We call it Indra's net. Indra's net. That we are all interrelated, not just we human beings all interrelated, but all sentient beings are interconnected. Not just all sentient beings, but those with partial sentience that haven't even come into full sentience yet. And I was trying to think, like, what could that be? You know? But then I thought, it could be something as simple as a virus. A virus is not even a living thing, yet it attaches to a host. I mean, like, what kind of science are we talking about here? You know, and that's why they can't do anything with it. I never knew that a virus was not a bio thingy. You know, that they don't call it alive at all. But it attaches to a host. And then, I don't know, it feeds off of a host. So it's a strange kind of phenomena. It doesn't have full sentience. You know, how could the Buddha know these things 2,500 years ago? No microscope, no telescope, all these other pieces of equipment we have that we have created and come up with. He got it through connecting with Prajna, which connects him to the whole universe. And that's what's available to us, in us. We call certain people geniuses. We talk about Einstein or we talk about Tesla, you know, but we don't know what we have to offer to the world that can be unlocked. We don't know what our visions are. We don't know what they are. But he says the only way you're going to know what they are is when you tap into your dharmic capacity, then these things start coming forward. Now, that means I bring it forth in a kind of religiously spiritual way, because that's just how I'm wired. You know, don't like that. Don't come hear me, because it's going to get there. You know, but there are other people who don't talk it out in this way. You know, there are many who meet with those who are of a literary bent, and they talk about the poems. I cannot get to them. I don't understand. I need all the words because I can't envision things with poems. But some people, you know, I mean, the poetry is so grand. It's so beautiful. It points them to the marvelousness of life. Some people do it through art and sculpture, you know. But that's all Dharma too, is what I'm saying to you. It's all the brightness resident in the universe. It's all of it. It's the science, it's the history, it's the literary, it's the art, it's the mechanical, it's the technical, it's all of that. And there are different ways that we bring forth our expression. So someone may be a practitioner, but they don't teach the Dharma, they draw. Someone may be a practitioner, but he's an architect. He brings forth the beauty of the universe through his design and through his structure. Can you see? So we have to be careful of what we're looking for and careful of where we can't pocket the Dharma. We can't like cut out a little box for it and that Dharma goes in that cubby hole right there and here's the whole rest of my life. But what happens is that Dharma has to be sprinkled over the whole field. And it brings forth a living reality. And if we have that, the world will be different. Everybody's not going to be in the Dharma hall. Everybody's not going to be in the church, in the synagogue, in the mosque. Everybody's not going to be in the field, you know, praising the fire god. Everybody's not going to be, you know, they're going to be going through the daily issues of life. But on some level, on every level, there is the Dharma. So the Dharma is given to us to awaken us to our true nature, to awaken us to, I won't say a sense of purpose, because there's no I that has a purpose. But it awakens us to be part and parcel of the experience of life. And we find that in our relationship with other people. I loved being a cloistered monastic. My books were my friends. But when I started really touching some places, you know, in my meditation, I got the signal. And the signal was, you need to cultivate more. It's not just about meditation. I was a meditating fool, meditating all the time. But it wasn't just about meditation. It was how I present my world for usage, how I present myself to the world for usage. And that meant then I had to come out of my little cubby hole and I had to begin to interact with others. It was so hard. So I really didn't want to be bothered with people. I really, really didn't. Not that there's anything wrong with people, but I came to know myself. And if that self that I knew was not compatible with seeing every other creature, then I have to change me. And I had to start doing the things I didn't want to do to change to become the person I want to become. And then you start to know the value of your life. You come to know that you are extremely valuable. You come to know that you're valuable because of your personage and not because of your wit or your intellect, but of the spark of life that you bring to the world. So in the beginning, we're forgetting about the self. At the end story, we can pick up the self that is empty. When I read from the Prajnaparamita, and that is said to be the highest of all the teachings. Did you know? I just took y'all right to the end of the book. The highest of all teachings. In the beginning, we're talking about eyes, nose, you know, mouth, with thoughts, seeing and hearing. It says we're talking about all of that at the beginning, and we start dismantling it. At the end of the teaching is no eyes, no nose, no ears. It is Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva practiced deeply. So there's an operative word, deeply. The Prajna Paramita, and illuminated the five aggregates and saw that they were all empty and thereby crossed over and beyond all suffering and adversity. So that means I can give up my things to be free, or I can give up me and be free. Then I can keep the things and I can enjoy them because I don't think of myself as solid and existing, but just a part of the process of arising and ceasing phenomena. Then I can enjoy my things because there's no grasping around them. And so you got a long way and you got a short way. You can got 5-step process and you can have a 1-step process. The problem with the 5-step process is it ties us up so tightly that we got to think we got to do this, we got to do that, don't taste this and don't touch that and don't handle that and don't enjoy that and don't. But no, when one is not attached to it, it can enjoy it all, because that which is unuseful and unbeneficial is the attaching. It can freely enjoy because there is no attachment. It says there is no hindrance. And because there's no hindrance, they have no fear. They have no fear And also, they dwell in an ultimate nirvana. So that's not a place. It's not a destination. It is a state of mind. So we thought we had to go somewhere. And he said, in that state of mind, they are not defiled or pure. They don't increase or decrease. Therefore, there is no concrete form or feeling or conceptualization or action, consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no mouth, no tongue, no body, no mind, no forms, no sounds, no smells, no tastes, no touches, no objects of mind, no realm of eyes, up to and including no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance, and no ending of ignorance, no aging and death, no ending of aging and death, no suffering, no accumulation, no cessation, no path. He starts off with an eightfold path, and at the end of his teachings, the emptiness. There is no path, no wisdom even, and no attainment. And with nothing to attain, their minds have no hindrance. So that's a glimpse, a snapshot of where we can go in the Dhamma. If we go beyond phase one, phase two, if we follow the journey all the way to the end and not get stuck choosing a seat and sitting down for the rest of your life in that space, but going beyond, that's what it means, gate, paragate. Parasamgate, Bodhi, Swaha. It's like gone beyond all conceptions, entering into the reality of the universe. And he says, and then you'll come to know that you are not separate from the entire universe. There is no knowledge to be gained out there. You are that which you seek. He said, it's like having a baby tied on your back and you're going around, where's my baby? Where's my baby? And it's tied right on your back. Do you believe it? Sometimes you don't know it because you haven't heard it. But once you hear it, you can't unhear it. Because a seed is planted. And even when the rain comes, meaning something that you don't want to happen, it still nurtures and causes that seed to grow. When the sun is shining, it nurtures and it causes that seed to grow. And there are little things that you can do to weed, fertilize. Don't put too much fertilizer because then it burns the roots. You have to learn how much. Oh, I put too much this time. I step back a little bit, you know. Another time it needs a little bit more. You get one of those apps that you can click on the plant and see what it needs, you know. And instead of like cutting, you pour a cup of vinegar in it or Coca-Cola or whatever it tells you to do. I mean, you know, you have to spiritually keep up with it. You got to step up, you know, because it's in this way that we grow in a living way and not like from a academic, intellectual standpoint. The things that matter most to us in this world cannot be evaluated or categorized intellectually or academically. We use words love, but what does that mean? The love that I have for my husband or for my wife or my child, How could I express that to you in a way that you actually feel it and know it? It's not possible, but it is possible for me to experience it and to know it. And the true Dharma is like that. It has to be experienced. Even the Buddha himself said that I cannot tell it to you. I can only point the way to it. It can be experienced, however, and you must experience it for yourself. So I hope as you go forward from today that your investigation of the Dharma takes on a different feel, a different approach, a different level of surrender and engagement. It takes on a spark of aliveness. It's not something that you do, but it's something that you are, and all of it is Dharma, but you're becoming more and more the Dharma, moving from knowing your ABCs to putting together words for some of you. For some of you, moving beyond putting together words to stringing along sentences. For some of you, moving beyond stringing along sentences to writing wonderful stories. And for some of you, just taking those stories and putting them into picture form. I have an appreciation for movies. You know, they say, that's the breaking of one of the Vinaya vows. But I personally, I'm not speaking for anybody else. Don't write me. Oh, that's, is this going to be public? In case... I'm going to just say this then. Okay, if this ever goes public, don't write me any letters about the behavior of monks, because we're not supposed to, go to movies and things like that. But I delight in them because, I don't have certain kinds of suffering in my life, but they help me to be acquainted with it, so that it increases my sympathy for those who are suffering in those kinds of situations. It allows me to touch it without having to experience it myself. Like you tell your children, don't stick your hand in the fire because it burns. You'll burn yourself. Burn? I mean, like, until they're burnt, they don't know what burn is. And so they put their hands in the fire anyway, and they get burnt. So I don't put my hands in the fire to know what burnt is. I mean, I can watch a movie and I can actually experience the pain because many people are suffering that. That energy is present in the world, But as I watch it and I open to the compassion, where I might not through direct experience or through erasure, I won't call it forgetfulness of how things I experienced in the past, but they are really like an illusion. Like, it's like they never happened. So I'm closing now. I want to say there was a time I was raped when I was, I think it was 19, sometime between 18 and 20, by my friends, my boyfriend's best friend. And, shortly after that, he left town. I tried to tell my boyfriend about it, but he was upset. He felt that his friend said that I enticed him and that was his best bud. And so I lost my boyfriend as well. And I can't describe the pain. There was one kind of pain with the violation. And there was a different kind of pain with the rejection of my boyfriend, and couldn't believe me. And why wouldn't he? I mean, that was more brutal for me than what had happened to me. But this guy left town, and I moved out of town some years later. And 10 years passed, and I was back in town visiting some friends in our old neighborhood, our old stomping ground. And I was in the grocery store, and I saw him. When my head turned and locked on him, he just so happened to be turning his head and locked on me, and he saw me. And he quickly ducked and went down another aisle. So I went and I found him. And I told him how happy I was to see him. I mean, we had been friends at one time, really friends, you know. And I said to him, "You don't have to duck or hide from me." I said, "I don't hold that against you." I said, "I did it one time, but I realized that it was only killing me. And the only way that I was going to be free was that I was going to have to forgive you for that." And I said, and I did. I mean, I truly did. And I am glad to see you. And he started talking to me. He told me about his life. He said that he couldn't figure out why he did that to me. He became a psychiatrist, trying to get himself free. I said, "I know something about them psychiatrists and stuff. I know they work through some things." And so he came to me, and he told me that. And he said, and I realized what happened. And he said he had been my best friend, my boyfriend. He had been my best friend ever since we were kids. And in all those years, we never let anyone else, not even a girlfriend, come between us. And you came between us. He chose you over me. And I was so angry with him. He said it didn't even have anything to do with you. He said, "I wanted to hurt him." And he said, "That's when I realized what I realized." And so I would tell the story. You know, I'm only in Dharma circles, so that's the only place I get to tell the story, you know. And I would, these women would go off. Because, I mean, it's frightening to say, but probably 40 or 50% of us have been abused, if the number's that low. That's samsara. That's this particular part of samsara that we live in. You get into some of the other heavens, you don't have to worry about that. You got other issues, though. But the predominant issues are for desire in this world, this human earthly world, is food and sex. That's it. That's how we handle our problems. That's how we forget our problems. That's how we, you know, you can just take it from A to Z, food and sex. And in some other realms, it's other things, like beautiful things. And when you get into the formless realm, it's like the excellency of the mind and thought. They don't even have things. They just think. And so the Buddha laid all of this out for us so we could know where we are at any given time and where we're headed at any given time. We can choose to go there or not go there. But know that every decision we make has a consequence. And that's what we call. So when we say karmic retribution, we only think about that's your karma when it's something not good. But whether you do a bad deed or a good deed, both of them have karma. I don't want to have to come back to reap rewards of good deeds. You know, I just wanted to be finished. And that's the good thing about practicing in this way. Practicing in this way, you not only eliminate repercussions from unwholesome actions, but you also don't have to be here to experience the goodness, the good things that come from having planted good seeds. I'm like, "That's okay. I give all my merit away. Y'all can have it. You know, I don't want a reason at all to have to come back to this world. I want to be able to choose." There's lots of places you can help. There's lots of beings you can help. They don't all have to be humans, you know. I'll check out another planet, another galaxy, another universe, another world. It's a big place out there. You know, I say this jokingly, but I also say it seriously. I really do. We have to get not so myopic, not so just tied down to this. There's a lot of beings that interfere with us because our minds are so unstable. They whisper. and we hear unconsciously and we act. Some of them, maybe I'll interact with some of them on another plane, in another sphere. Some of them are fierce because they got some abilities too, you know? Because whatever you practice, you'll get good at that. That's just a universal law. You'll get good at being bad. You'll get good at being good, you know? That doesn't mean that you're higher in you know, in stature. It just means that you practiced that thing until practice became perfect. So that's not your only qualifier for nobility. You need to know all the qualifiers for nobility. There's so much to learn. There's so much to know. There's so much to perfect. It'll cure your boredom. It would. So I think that's all that I want to say. I think it's enough. It might have been too much, but you can just pick one or two or three things, you know, something that stood out for you, and work on that. Everything's not for everybody, but something is for somebody. The Dhamma is very individual like this. It's called, they have two things. One is called shared Dhamma, and one is the unshared Dhamma. Shared Dhamma are just principles and precepts that are standard and universal. Unshared Dhamma is Dhamma that's specifically given from the teacher to, in the old days, they would say specifically given from the master to the disciple, a direct mind-to-mind transfer of information that can go in deep, that they can use to cure their particular kind of suffering. So all of us are familiar with the shared Dhamma, but maybe not so familiar with the unshared. So it's great when we have an opportunity to get a transmission that goes deep for us. I thank you all for coming.